They spoke about your arm not being down beside your side. I mean, this is not Irish dancing.
OTB Sports Radio.
Basketball would have been my main game.
The brand new sports radio station from Off the Ball.
That's my point. Don't play for us if you're a proud Englishman.
Now broadcasting 24 hours a day. Live on the Go Loud app. Alexa.
You have a whole new world of possibilities.
Google Home. Tune in. And offtheball.com/radio.
This is OTB Sports Radio.
The OTB Podcast Network.
Rugby on Off the Ball.
With Vodafone, official sponsors of the Irish rugby team. Team of us. Everyone in.
Now this week on our Sunday evening rugby corner, delighted to welcome former Munster back row, 139 appearances for the men in red between 2006 and 2014. James Collin, currently defence and forwards coach for Provence Rugby in the south of France. Thanks a million for joining us this evening.
No problem. You're more than welcome. Happy to do it.
How are you getting on these days? What's life like in France?
Pretty much the same as it's like in Ireland. We're all locked in looking at ourselves. Doing as much work as we can. Just off a visio with one of the lads just to go through lineouts and stuff like that. But it's tough going. It's not easy, but hopefully we'll all come out the other side of us healthier anyway. So, yeah.
And you mentioned there you're kind of still on the team calls and stuff and checking in with players. I presume has a decision been made on the French season? Is that done for the rest of the season? Obviously, we would have seen a lot of other sports, obviously in France, have been called off until September. So is your season done now?
Absolutely, yeah. They announced, when was it? Last week, actually, I think the Prime Minister made an announcement that the seasons were finished until September. So the plan of attack is basically restart the season on the weekend of the 4th or 5th of September. And there's loads of protocols and stuff now that have been put in place in regards to how we can get back into group training and stuff. Majority of the clubs, we've a meeting on Tuesday with the president and all the players just to decide how we're going to work out the next few weeks. I know a few of the top 14 clubs, Bordeaux and a few others, are going to take their holidays early because the players are entitled to their 4 weeks holidays and then we attack the season. So I think pretty much everyone is going to look at maybe taking 3 weeks holidays in May and then working in back into the protocol. So the protocol is quite strict, and so we need to be well on top of everything before the lads start coming back into pre-season and stuff.
Yeah, and I suppose you probably don't want the players to be, I don't want to say you don't want to give them too much time off, but you don't want rust to set in or anything like that. You don't want them to be coming back into a pre-season having not really done anything for a while.
Yeah.
You do need to kind of keep the body ticking over for a little bit.
Absolutely. They've all got programs, and the SNC are looking after having individual meetings with guys and keeping track on what they're doing. And in one sense, you're trying to get head start in, okay, well, look, if we work really hard, then we're going to be in better place than everybody else. But the other thing is that we still have 16, 18 weeks of a preseason that's probably going to be facing into. And the worry then is into overload and training and risk of injuries and risk of risking everything that could go, you know, outside of the coronavirus stuff, everything that could go a bit pear-shaped. So we're just trying to make sure that we're as prudent as possible without, as you say, rust settling in. But I think there'll be a period of adaptation for everyone, no matter whether you're in Provence Rugby or Munster and Leinster. I think we're all going to pretty much be on the same boat and trying to look for the small advantages and the small things that might give us an edge going into the season, you know.
So tell us about the role you've been in now for all of this season, Provence Rugby. I would say a lot of people over here probably wouldn't really know too much about the club.
No. I was with 2 years with the CDF in Pau after I retired. So I was responsable sportif with the CDF. And as part of that, I was doing my diplomas, same as everybody else, all the coaches' diplomas. So I spent two years up and down to Marcosi in the Federation. Just ticking off the boxes in regards to everything. It was good, a good experience in regards to, you know, opening yourself up to like having to train under eights and under tens and stuff like that. Going back, you know, the first year was pretty much like really back down to the basics. And
so you were properly teaching the kids how to play.
We'd go to Marcosi on the Monday, so we'd arrive on Monday. Tuesday would be theory, and then Wednesday you'd go to a club and you'd go take the under 12s, the under 14s, the under 16s, the under 8s. I don't know how anybody coaches under 8s or under under 6s. I take their hat off to them. Because at the end of it, I said to one of the guys, I said, like, if I want to play with the kids, I'll play with my own kids. Like, I'm here to try and learn how to be a professional coach. But there's like, if you can coach the under sixes, you can coaching the French team isn't going to be any problem for you. So it was good. It's a good exposure to everything. And then last year it was more into the management and into the actual professional game. And I met the manager of Province Rugby while I was there. As it turned out, the director of the Centre for Formation and Pool took up a post with Province, and he called me to see would it be interesting to take up the post. There wasn't going to be anything in pool. It wasn't really that, you know, it was the choice of staying or going. I was, you know, I wanted to get into a professional level, and I felt that this was the next step on that. It's down in Aix. It's a beautiful part of France. Very, you know, wealthy area. So it's very expensive, but it's beautiful, and there's a good appetite to grow the club. So there's a new training center going in, a 35 million training center, so they're investing in the club. We're putting in two new synthetics onto the training pitch, and the playing pitch will be a synthetic, a bit like Musgrave Park, right, for example. And we're just trying to advance the club in small steps. So it's good. It's a good building experience. It's a good experience to be into professional games, into dealing with presidents and players and contracts, and because we haven't got a massive staff, so we're all kind of tied into a bit of everything. So it's good.
On a personal level, how have you found the step up from teaching academy kids, what you would have been kind of doing the S-bars at Pau, to being with full professional players on a daily basis, and being in charge of a department as such, you know, whether it's the forwards or defence or something? How have you found that transition?
It's been great. It's the academy is excellent because it gives you a great grounding in the technical side of the game. In fact, because you kind of try and, what we try to do is break down the game into the small bits for the players and let them improve the small details in regards to the technique and into the mental aspect of the game as well, not being selected, being left out of games and stuff like that. And how are you going to deal with it? What are you going to do in regards to extras? Because with the S-bars, half the team is carrying bags for half the week with the pro team. Tackle bags or whatever it is, but they're the opposition for the whole week, so you have to really go into detail. And so that stood to me well, I think, in the professional game, because the devil is really in the detail. So we try and be as detailed as we can, and without being on the other side of the office now, not knocking on the door, the fellas have a knocking at the door, that you're trying to be as honest and constructive as possible. And not giving an opinion. I think the hardest part for players is that sometimes the decision is an opinion and it's not based on anything, whereas we've tried and take out the opinion that, look, we can statistically, we can show you why you're not playing. And then obviously there are times where you have to give an opinion, you have to choose, and there isn't a real valid reason that you can give guys after it. But I think the step up has been great, and the fact that we're in a small group has been excellent, because I'm kind of getting exposed to everything. Like, you know, Regina Wingers, who are trying to, it's funny, I was watching Stuart Lancaster the other day on one of the webinars. He was saying, you know, the winger will always say to you, I need to cover the backfield, and you need to be able to explain to him why he shouldn't be covering the backfield, for example. And you tend to view the game in the position you played. So he was saying, as a seven, I tend to view, when I started out, to view the game as a seven. Me as an eight probably did the same thing, and having to take a step back and see where the open spaces are, why we would be under pressure if they go there and stuff like that. So it's been, I'm really enjoying it. I'm really, really enjoying the challenge, because it's a big challenge.
Was the coaching thing something that you would have thought a good while back that this is something you wanted to do, or is it something that kind of would have just grown on you down over the years?
I think I always wanted to, because if I wasn't coaching, I'd probably ended up teaching. That would have been where I would wanted to go. I was starting with Sedanta College when I was playing, in regards to doing the sports science to become a PE teacher at the end of it. And then obviously with the move to France, that kind of backed the brakes. We put on that a bit. And so the fact that you are teaching, you know, you're still teaching kids. They're grown adults, like they're 130 kg kids, but they're still kids. And we're still chasing an oval ball around the 100-meter pitch, you know what I mean? So it's absolutely nuts, but we're still getting paid to do it, so it's brilliant. I'm trying to make the most of it while we're still getting the chance to enjoy ourselves, you know?
And what were you doing? What did you do in your past life, for example, before you would have made the breakthrough at Munster?
Because
you were in your mid-20s at that point, like, so I imagine there was a workplace at that stage.
There was, yeah. I was a sales rep for O2 for a couple of years. I was in university. When I came out of university, I tried to do accounting for a couple of years, and it wasn't right for me. I shouldn't have even tried. And I still thank Brian Hyland for giving me a chance to realize that it probably really wasn't for me. But I was working as a sales rep and, on the business side of things for O2 as well as the commercial side. So it was you're driving around, you're getting your sandwich on the road, and then you're getting into training in the evening if you can, or you're trying to do weights at 7 or in the morning before you start doing your rounds, and you realize how lucky you are then when you do get into the professional setup, is that, you know, maybe it just gives you that appetite to try and not get back into that environment, you know what I mean, that you have to that we have such a, you know, when you're in the bubble, it's very easy to just get caught up in that bubble, that you lose sight of actually how lucky you are. And I think I was chatting to Peter O'Reilly yesterday, and I was just saying to him, I think the importance of guys like Marcus and Dennis Hurley and stuff, and Simon Hickey, in regards to the players' union and making sure that guys are prepared when they come out of when they come out of the bubble, because we're not like footballers. We're not, you know, you don't retire and that's it. You don't have to work anymore. Fellas are being better paid now than they were maybe when I finished, you know, which is great for them. But we're not footballers, you know. There's no. I was saying to one of the directors in the club, comes from St. Etienne. He was in football in St. Etienne when they had Eden Hazard and really international players. And I said, like, the difference between rugby and football is that when your contract is up, you need a new one. Whereas a football player's, his contract really is never up, because he's probably sold before his contract is up, or, you know, if they leave it run to the end, he doesn't really care at that stage, because he's cashing in basically. And, you know, how many examples of Chelsea have had fellas that are, you know, played 2 games for the reserves and been there for 5 years, you know what I mean? So that doesn't happen in rugby. So I think the fact that guys really need to be switched on about what they want to do afterwards and how they want to live, because, as I say, it's not going to be forever, and I've been lucky enough, and I'll try and stay in the professional game for as long as I can. But sure, you know, it's a perception. If the president comes in next week and says, James, hasn't worked out, so off you go. Yeah, and, you know, there's lots of fellas or even that kind of situation as well, you know.
And before you get into the professional environment, you had to earn your stripes, you had to plug away in the AIL with Dolphin for quite a while. At what point along that journey did the idea of professional rugby actually come along? Like, for example, I was on this lot last week, we had Ali Muldowney, who had played with Connacht, and he was even later making the professional breakthrough. Mm. I think he was 26, nearly 27 by the time he played his first professional game. Obviously, you were a year or two earlier than that. Mm. But at what point in the club rugby stage did it actually kind of appear you might have a chance of maybe breaking in and getting a couple of games at Munster and impressing?
Which the World Cup in France was in 2006, was it? was it
2007 in France?
Seven in France. So it was the end of the 2006 season. I played, I think the 2005-2006 season, I played maybe three or four A games. We played Leinster and Ross Grey. We played in Water Park against an English team or a Welsh team. I played, I think, three or four A games it was before there was the Celtic Cup or the BNI Cup or anything like that. It was just, there was kind of a mix of guys playing, like Mushy would have been playing, for example, Tony Buckley would have been playing. You could have, Mossy was playing, Mossy Lawler would have been playing at 10. You guys playing, there were, I think Colin McMahon might have played a couple of games with me as well. I would play a couple of games with Gary Owen and stuff. And I think, you know, when you go through school and you go through the Irish schools, the Munster schools, and then you don't get into at the time when I finished school, it was the Irish Academy. It wasn't the Munster Leinster Academy. It was the Academy was directly in Congo's pretty much the whole year. And then you had the foundations were in the clubs in the provinces. So I was in the Munster Foundation, but I wasn't in the Academy. So you train with Mark McDermott and Ultimo Callaghan maybe two nights a week in UCC. And then, but then that kind of just went by the wayside. And I you know, you never really give up hope because I was determined to try and get in and try and crack it and try and give it a go. And I always felt because like fellas like Leamy and Kyo and stuff like that, who would have been ahead of me getting into the professional game. I was playing with Irish schools and I always felt like I was as good as them. I could be as competitive as them. I was given a shot to train every day, to have the right nutrition to do it. And I was very lucky with a Decky. I think I was like top try scorer in the AAL my last season, not having a pro contract or development contract. And Decky was obviously a Dolphin man. He'd been at a lot of the game. And Brian Hickey was in Conn. He was the Forest coach of Munster at that stage. So they'd see me. But I think the development contract was Decky was kind of saying, look, we could give you 3 months for the summer to see how you go. And I said, no, I need to give it a full crack. And give it a full crack, I'll get, you know what I mean? We'll go the whole hog. And I was lucky. Garrett Fitzgerald, who was my coach in school, was the CEO of Munster. I just got a crack and I played a good few games at the start of the year, but unfortunately Ireland got knocked out of the World Cup early. So I was like, Axel was back, Donegal was back, Paulie was back. We were kind of hoping to go quarterfinal, semi-final, final. I remember saying to Foggs, Dennis Fogarty, he was like, Christ, they're on the way back already. We haven't even got a shot. But I got a few games. We played against Ospreys in Tumlin Park. It was one of my first and second game at Munster. I got mad at a match and stuff like that. And I just felt, I can hang in here, you know. If I can just hang in. Because I think it was only like 100 kgs when I signed. And I knew I needed to get bigger and stronger and faster. And if I can hang in for a season or two here, I can really develop and get on. And that's what it worked out to be really in the end.
And the process of getting bigger, is that a case of do the weights and shovel the food in?
Pretty much. I was fat. I'm coming back to being the same way I was before. You think you're in shape, but you're not. You're nowhere near in shape. I'm just looking at Wally and Trevor Halstead, and these guys are unbelievable athletes. Paulie ripped to shreds and 115 kgs, and I was like 100 kgs with a big bear belly on top of it. Not a bear belly, but I wasn't drinking, so I wasn't a bear belly, but like, you know, effectively baby fat, because I wasn't doing weights constantly. I wasn't eating what I should have been eating. I wasn't, you know, being as hydrated, being as concentrated on what I should have been. And it did take me a good two or three seasons to get my body in a position where, you know, week to week you can do it. Because when your body isn't where it should be, you can be very good for 1 week, but the 2 weeks afterwards you mightn't be as good. And you think you're great, you think you're doing it all, but effectively it's your body is letting you down. And I think it was like two or three years before I actually got a hang of that, where it was kind of I think one of the days, Revs, who was still in the suits in Munster, I came into Revs to get a rub after him. Oh, you're after shredding down a bit there, boy, aren't you? I was like, oh, Christ, if he's after noticing it, then it must be after working a bit. So, yeah, no, so, yeah, as I say, it took a few years. And it's funny, I would have said when I started playing that putting on weight is much harder than losing weight because it's... you have to eat more and you train, you burn a lot of calories. But no, I can tell you, when you stop playing, it's much harder to lose weight than it is to put on weight now. So it's come full circle.
It was interesting, though, a few minutes ago, you mentioned how, like, when you were playing in the AL and trying to get the breakthrough, you were very determined that you were, you know, trying to put the best foot forward and get a foot in the door somehow. Like, there would be a lot of players that go through that, the age grade stuff with their provinces and the representative teams, and ultimately, as you were saying, the National Academy at the time, but the Provincial Academy contracts don't really arrive, and there is a huge amount of them that just fall off the grid and don't even go out and play AAL rugby. They might play the odd bit of junior stuff, but ultimately there are a huge number of promising careers that are probably drifting off because they see the door being closed if they're not getting in there straight away at 19 or 20.
Absolutely, and it's one of the difficulties. The benefits of being in Ireland is that everything is the career path is planned out for you. You know what I mean? Like the pyramid is the Irish team and everything filters on from the Irish team. And that's brilliant if you can stay on that pyramid. The problem is the amount of guys that fall off that pyramid. There's only 4 professional teams in the country. You know, I'm in Po at the moment with the convenement, and just being in Po here at the moment, you have Po, Tarb is a Federal 1 team, is professional, Dax is a professional setup. And Dimitri Ashvili and Augustine Benoit, the coaches in Dax now. You have Buritz, Bayonne, Toulouse, Bordeaux, Mont-de-Marsan. After you go a bit further into Balignac, Colomiers, I'm just trying to think, is there Albi, Agen? So, like in 250, if you did as the crow flies around me here, I know about 250 kilometers, there's about 10 professional teams. And where the guys in Toulouse, everybody wants to play for Toulouse or Bordeaux or Pau. If they don't make it, then there's the next tier is the probably 2 teams. If you don't make it, the next tier is the Federal 1 teams. We just don't have that system in Ireland. And I think it's difficult for guys then to jump ship. It's a big thing. Changing countries. Because I remember Squeaky saying to me, we were coming back from an A game. Squeaky was one of the A coaches.
Can you give Squeaky's full name?
Yeah. Brian Walsh. struggled. Thanks for that. Who was the con coach at the time, who then the year I left, went in as back coach with the... You put me on the spot with that. Okay, I was able to get it out. So Squeaks was in the A coach, and then he took a sabbatical from the bank to go in with Axel and Mikko and Jerry when they took over in Munster after Rob Penny. And he said, you know, James, there's, if you look at it in football terms, Munster is Manchester United. There's nothing wrong with playing with Wimbledon. There's nothing wrong with playing with you know, with first division clubs. There's nothing wrong with that. Guys play, you know, there's guys playing with Blackburn, there's guys playing with Reading, there's guys playing with Leeds, there's guys playing with, but they're living their dream, you know what I mean? And, you know, Munster or Leinster or Connacht, they're the Manchester Uniteds, the Man Cities, the Paris Saint-Germains of rugby. And it's amazing that we're at that level now, whereas, you know, not to have an Irish team in the top 4 of Europe, you're scratching the head going, what the hell just happened? But that means that there is a lot of guys who are in that system that will lose out on not playing for Manchester United, because if the club feels that, like, if you're a young second row in Munster today, you've just signed that they've signed a World Cup winning second row, what do I do? You know what I mean? If I'm Darren O'Shea, or if I'm, you know, where do I go? What do I do? Do I stay, or do I try and fight it out? Am I going to be happy to play Celtic Cup? And I think Duncan Williams spoke really well when he retired about all that, and the fact that, you know, that, you know, you do your best and you're getting criticised, but like the people's exception of of where you are and the reality of how it is that is are two different things completely. Mm-hmm. I think if guys don't want to go, you have to respect their decision that, okay, we haven't cracked it. We haven't made it in Ireland. I haven't cracked it. Like I remember Scott Deasy, who really retired from professional rugby very, very young, but he just said, look, all I ever wanted to do was play for Munster. And when I didn't, when that wasn't the reality for me anymore, I didn't want to play professional rugby. I just, okay, I'm going to commit to my career. And then he goes on and wins three or four things. He has two or three AILs. He's won with Lansdowne, and he's now coaching in the coaching setup on Lansdowne. And that was his way of staying in rugby. But like other guys who want to go into professional rugby will go, you know, shouldn't be afraid of adventure, because Ireland will always be there. You know what I mean? We'll always be able to come home. Like, you know, home is always Cork, or, you know, it's not going anywhere. With the help of God, it's not going anywhere. But, you know, there's nothing wrong with 23, 24, just saying, look, this hasn't worked out here. That doesn't mean it's not going to. Like James Downey, I was reading James Downey in the 42 the other day, you know, Calvisano, Northampton, gone. You know, it's a different type of life, and you never know what you're going to run into or how you're going to be unless you just take a punt and jump on the bus and see what happens, you know.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned obviously how steep that pyramid is in Irish rugby, where you have so few teams. Like, you were in the unlucky situation, obviously, around that time, where you would have had, like, just off the top of the head, Anthony Foley, David Wallace, Alan Quinlan, Dennis Leamy around there. Like, some of the best back rows that have played rugby in Ireland in the last 20, 30 years. Like, you had to be very, very patient, even when you did get the foot in the door initially.
Yeah, and you have to realize that, you know, you're playing against Axel. You know what I mean? You're putting your hand up against Axel. I mean, Christ, oh, wow, but you know what I mean? That's, you know, when I think back about it, I think, oh, how naive was I? You know what I mean? To think that, you know, that I could live. But, you know what I mean? Maybe naive and stupidity and stubbornness was what served me in the end to crack it. You know what I mean? That, like, just to get my foot in the door was one thing, but like Raj saying it about playing for Ireland, there's one thing to play for Ireland, it's another thing to win for Ireland, you know what I mean? And you go from, okay, I want to get my foot in the door, and then I want to be kicking in his door, kicking in Decky's door, or Dumper's door, or Tony McGann, or Laurie's door, or Axe's door, to say, why aren't I playing? And being valid in your response to asking why you're not playing. But there's an awful lot of work that goes into that. You have to be patient. You have to be pig ignorant about it as well. You have to have a kind of an inner ignorance about it. Like, oh, I don't care about your opinion. I'm going to keep working. I'm going to change your opinion on me. And I think if fellas who arrive at the as high as they can go will have that bit of a bit of not arrogance, but in self-belief and self-determination that, look, if you think that, I think something else, and I'm going to keep going until I can prove myself right. And if you don't have that, you definitely won't go all the way. You definitely won't get to as high as you can go, because there's no limit. There's no thing that says this is where you have to stop. You know what I mean? Like, it would have been easy for me to say, oh, well, I have to stop because I'm no longer in the academy. Nobody decides that. No, the only one that decides that is yourself, and you have to take responsibility for that decision yourself, you know.
Mm-hmm. So when you went in, and when you were first on a proper contract at Munster, straight away, were you kind of deliberately being a little bit bullish and trying to make sure that, you know, that you weren't standing off almost in the conversation, that, you know, you were there and you had to be a part of it, or were you allowing yourself to kind of just grow into that?
It was kind of a bit of both. I've probably been a pain in the ass for a lot of fellas, you know what I mean? I probably spoke too much, looking back at it. I should have just shut up and listened to what the guys who were doing it were actually... I had an opinion, and I wasn't afraid to give it, but I thought it was valid. If it was valid, I'd say it. If it wasn't, but I looking back on it as a... You know, from a coaching point of view now, I definitely should have shut up for the first couple of years. I just should have kept my mouth shut and just looked at what was going on and tried to learn more. rather than thinking, I know it everything, I know it all, don't worry, I know everything. So isn't the case, even though you're still learning on a day-to-day basis. That would be the one bit of advice that I give myself now looking back, would be just keep your mouth shut, keep your head down and work your ass off. You don't need to give your opinion all the time. You just need to keep your mouth shut and keep your head down. And then afterwards, I always felt like I had to do every training session to 100%, because if I didn't get anywhere near it, if I wasn't 100% at training, I wasn't going to be playing. And, you know, there'd always be scraps, there'd always be, you know, we were never afraid to have a punch-up at training, like, between ourselves. Sometimes we were even afraid if we didn't have a punch-up at training that there was something wrong, that we weren't competitive, we weren't ready for the weekend because we haven't had that punch-up during the week, that we just accepted it. And then there was, you know, and then I did do a lot of double trainings. Like, I did do a lot of, you know, training in the morning in the gym. And when we would go to Limerick, for example, I'd go to the Limerick in the morning. I'd go with Tomás and Dunnick or Dennis Hurley, and go to the gym in the morning. We got to Limerick, then we'd have one session in the morning, and then we'd have an afternoon session. We'd kind of have a walkthrough in the morning, and then we'd have an afternoon session where we'd go. And if you were in the subs or if you weren't in the group, you were on the kick shit side. You were, you know, there will probably be an argument on a Tuesday, certainly on a Tuesday, on a Thursday, less likely because the contact levels were down, but some Thursdays were the mauling sessions, and then there'd definitely be a bust up. But the majority of the time for the first few years, I was then getting in the car, going to Cork, and then going training for Dolphin and playing for Dolphin on the Saturday. So I could end up doing three or four sessions on a Thursday afternoon, or Thursday total. I could actually end up doing four sessions. And, you know, that probably stood to me in the end, you know what I mean? And the fact that I was working that a little bit more than probably everyone else was, you know, because we had Dave O'Mahony was our coach in Dolphin when I was there for the majority of it, while I was still playing with Dolphin. And there was no 50-50 sessions with Dave. Like, we had a rucking net, and it was down, you were doing the rucking work, and you were doing full-on tackle. It was bone-on-bone. There was no, you know, half sessions as we were only doing touch. It was all full-on. And because of in a club level, he only had the two sessions a week to prepare for the match on the Saturday. So you can understand why he was looking for us to do bone and bone and whatever it is. Obviously, in a professional game, you don't have to do the bone and bone because the lads only need to play one game a week. But I think that probably the extra work, and I didn't think of it as extra work. I just thought, like, I was going playing for Dolphin at the weekend, so I need to go training on the Thursday night. And I never kind of arrived because there was a few of the other monster lads I didn't know that would just arrive to Thursday, but just watch the session and just kind of hang around and say, no, I trained today, you know, don't worry about it. I just watch the line outs and I'll get the calls. And then, whereas I was putting on my boots and we were doing normal training, like, I was just mucking in with everybody else, you know.
For how long would you have been kind of doing that, trying to do the extra little bit? At what point did you feel that, you know, you're actually here and you're part of this?
I think I played my last game for Dolphin was 2009 against Shannon. It was, because I have a picture at home of it. And so that would have been 2009 was the last time I'd have played for Dolphin. And then I would still come down on a Thursday or watch the session or be around the fellas wanting to do extras and stuff, but I wouldn't be putting on the boots, or, you know what I mean, I'd be around a bit, but not always there and there a bit and doing a bit for them in regards to the press, or, you know, if they wanted to give out the medals and stuff like that to be on for this, because Tomás O'Leary was with me as well and we were together and we were both in Dolphin, so we'd kind of go, all right, come on, we'll go straight to training afterward and we'll just throw our head in anyway for half an hour. But I still felt... I'd still go to Laurie Fisher pretty much the whole time while Laurie was there, and we'd do extras. I always felt I had to do extras. I didn't think, there was no point where I didn't think I needed to do extras. And sometimes I wouldn't do them straight after the session. Sometimes it would be, I'd come in on the Wednesday and do a bit of extras with Laurie in regards to technique, the breakdown, or in regards to when Darbs was there. Darbs got me in the best physical shape that I could have been in with Aidan O'Connor. Aidan was brilliant with me because he was a pain in the ass, and we'd end up fighting each other, and you know, we'd be giving out. He'd be screaming at me, I'd be screaming at him, but it was what I needed. He knew that that was what I needed, and he knew that I needed to sometimes vent it against him. Like, it was his fault that I was having to work this hard, but it wasn't at all. He was just being there to facilitate me. I'll be speaking to Aidan on Wednesday. I still have a really good relationship with Aidan in regards to everything, and in regards to rugby, because he was such a big influence on me, because he was like, you're doing it. Like, I don't care if you're tired. I don't care if you're doing it, because you need to do it. And it was exactly what I needed. And there's so many people in Munster that nobody knows about that are like that really were the driver behind everything that we were doing, you know?
Mm-hmm. Over those years then, like, you had, there were great days. Like, I mean, the, you know, winning the Celtic League title in 2011 was obviously fantastic. Two great games I would imagine to be a part of as well. The All Blacks game in 2008, you mm-hmm. played in that, I'm almost I'm certain. And then Australia, when you beat them in mm-hmm. 2010 as well. Like, these kind of games, they almost seem like a kind of a relic of rugby 20 years ago. You really don't see the touring sides on a winter's evening on a Wednesday night. Like, I remember being at the Australia game. Didn't get a ticket for the All Blacks one a couple of years earlier. But I remember being at that Australia game, and it was the most miserable, I think it was a Tuesday or a Wednesday night.
Wednesday night.
Absolutely bucketing rain. But it just felt absolutely brilliant, like a packed Comer Park on a Tuesday evening for like a touring Australian side, which had a couple of, you know, a few pretty good players in it as well. And you sent them packing.
They're brilliant. They're great souvenirs. I remember going into the change room afterwards, because as you say, I was captain for the match in Australia, and we went into the game after into the change room, and I was chatting with Barry Barnes afterwards, and I was just sitting down. And I remember looking over, and there was one of the young fellas from Darwin who'd never seen rain in his life like he had seen. He was wrapped up, I'm not joking, wrapped up in the hypothermia blanket. He had never experienced cold like it in his life. And we were inside, and I was like, it's windy, but it's not that bad, you know. It wasn't as bad as going to Galway and the sports ground on New Year's Eve, you know, when you've the sand from the pit, from the dogs coming in on top of you, so you were all sunburned on your arms. It was freezing cold. It was lashing rain, and we were like, it's cold, but it's not. You know what I mean? It's not nice, but it's not. It's not the worst that we've ever played in. And like the All Blacks match was just, just something special. I mean, even. I think it was Raj. I even remember Raj coming in. He said, like, this is probably the best event I've ever been to in my life. Like, between the helicopters coming down, the two hackers, the whole, like, the rugby was nearly here and there. You know what I mean? It was just one of those nights that was just amazing. The crowd was mental, the hacker, and then you're just trying to come back, and we were like, we played UL Bulls on the Tuesday before that match, and they beat us with the team that was starting. And they beat us, or there was only a point or two between us or something like that. And we were like, the Bulls are going to beat us. What hope have we against the All Blacks? You know what I mean? And it wasn't the Mickey Mouse All Blacks team. Like, Kieran Reid was playing. I swapped jerseys with Adam Thompson, was playing with good 50 caps. Jose Guerra was on the wing. I'm just trying to go over. Liam Messon was playing.
Joe Rakitoko scored the winning try.
Thanks for that. Yeah. 78 minutes. Yeah. So no, but like they're special nights. They're lovely. It's something lovely to be able to show the, like, my son was looking at the old matches on YouTube there last week. I was like, throw on one of the matches there for the half to see. And they're brilliant, you know, like days like Toulouse and Thomond Park, you know, and they're just, or Harlequins away, and, you know, they're just lovely. It's nice to be able to look back on them, and pity we didn't get to lift more trophies, because we were just at the pox of the semi-final. I don't know how many semi-finals I lost, but there was way too many semi-finals. But and it's we were good enough. But then when you watch back the actual matches, like we were, I watched the Toulon game with Finn last week, and we just threw it away. When you watch it back, like we literally gave them the match. But yes, look, they are they're brilliant, but they're a long time behind me now, unfortunately.
was it a tough decision to leave when you did, because you left in 2014? You still had a year left on the contract.
Yeah, I did, and Garrett was brilliant. It was very hard. It was, you know, because you spend your life, all you want to do is play for Munster. You know what I mean? And it was really, really difficult. It was just a really difficult decision. I didn't think I was ever going to get a crack with Ireland at that stage. I thought like I deserved a crack at a point. And then there was a tour. I think there was a tour to America that summer, because it was the Lions year. It might have been the Lions year or something. Or I think it was America and Canada. And I thought I'd done enough, considering that like Jamie, I knew Jamie was going to go. I knew there was a good chance Shawnee, Peter O'Mahony would probably be in and around the mix. I thought that, you know, on the basis of everything, we're in the semi-final of the Heineken Cup, blah, blah, blah. I was like, and then when I didn't get in, I was like, look, you know, there isn't any, I'm never going to get another chance to go to change, because I'll finish out the contract and then I'll be too old. I'll be, you know what I mean? I might get another year at Munster if I was lucky. Maybe two, and then you retire. So I was like, look, it's a chance to experience something different, to go and experience a different lifestyle and everything, and that's what we did, you know.
Did you think you'd still be there, what, 6.5 years later?
No, I probably had 2 years in my head, and then I would come back, you know what I mean? Like, there was no real plan, like, six-year plan or anything like that, you know what I mean? It was... we'll go, we'll see how it works out, and if it doesn't work out, sure, in 2 years you can come back. If you know what I mean, you just come back. But it's been, yeah, we're here. Anyway, so it's been great. It's been brilliant.
And I imagine the plan is France for another few years at this rate?
Yeah, I have another year with Provence, and then we'll see what happens there. And I think if you're in professional setup, you want to get back into a professional setup at home. And I think that's professional coaching. And to do that, like, you know, you need to make a career path to looking at what Prendy was doing. So, you know, Prendy was like in 42, and then he went up into top 14, and then he's changed a couple of clubs. But, you know, I'm looking at it like that as well. And Raj would say the same thing about, you know, before you even think about things. Applying for stuff at home, you need to have a fairly good. I'm looking at Kazi's in Wasps. You know, there's guys we're all a bit spread out now around the place, but I think you know, the majority of us are looking at a plan to maybe at one stage try and make an impact at home as well. I spoke with Felix 3 weeks ago, just about his experience with the World Cup and stuff like that, and see how he was getting on. It's like coaching wise now, is the problem. No, it's not a problem, but the thing about going home is you probably get one crack at it, maybe one crack at doing something. You won't get three or four. So when you do go, you want to be as prepared as possible to give it as much as you can and give it the best crack you can and see, because I think the likelihood of having the days of like Decky Bruce there for 6 or 7 years, and you know, they're getting fewer and fewer. Leo would be a good example of that now. That, you know, his staff are amazing. He's a brilliant staff, like Stuart Lancaster. You know, you're looking at McBride as your scrum club, Filippo Contopomi, guys who have a connection with Leinster, as well as guys who haven't got a connection with Leinster but have an experience that would be a brilliant connection with them, in regards to Felipe, for example. And I think that, like with Connacht and Munster, you know, Connacht staff is Connacht lads, Ulster, you know, with Dan McFarlane and Kieran Campbell in the academy. And I think to keep the connection is vitally important going forward. And I spoke with Peter Malone last week in regards to the academy and Munster about what they're doing and stuff. So, look, it's the plan is to stay in professional sport, professional rugby. The plan is to continue my personal progression as well as picking up as much experience and stuff as I can, and just to keep going and see where we end up and try and be as pig ignorant as I was as a player, as a coach as I was as a player. So yeah.
Well, James, it's been an absolute pleasure chatting to you this afternoon, and the very best of luck with everything with Province for next season as well, and hopefully we'll speak to you again soon here on Off the Ball.
No problem, anytime.
Rugby on Off the Ball
with Vodafone, official sponsors of the Irish rugby team. Team of us, everyone in.
That was an OTB Podcast Network presentation.